We'll decipher our way through this rain report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the not-so-cryptic studios of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, with this rain report. The French Resistance and a number of civilians kept tabs on the German military and high command during World War II. They surreptitiously transmitted coded data back to the Allies at great personal risk. Tom Pereira, Ph.D., W1TP, an authority on those clandestine radio operations of World War II, spoke at the 2015 Dayton Hamvention. Here's the last of that presentation.
We're going to take you now to Norway, to Bergen, and show you how spies operated out of a particular city. In Bergen, there was a group of spies called the Theta Group. And they lived and performed most of their work in a room which has now been called the Theta Room. When Norway was invaded by the Germans, initially Bergen Seaport looked like a row of old buildings. The Germans came, they took over, and the buildings to this day still look very much the same. But if you look at an overhead view of the seaport and the buildings, and you look very carefully, you can find in the very back part of one of these buildings, the Theta Room. It's located in a very difficult place to get to. It's a pretty good, well-hidden spy locale. First thing you have to do is you have to walk down this long corridor from the seaport to the back of the building. And then, once you're at the back of the building, you have to know to go up these stairs. And you go up to the second floor of this old building. And when you're up in the second floor, you have a bunch of old furniture. You have to walk by the furniture and find your way to the back here and go through a door and then find your way up a set of stairs. And there's a wooden roof over the stairway, so it looks like it's closed off and unused. But when you finally get there, you find the Theta Room. The door has a rather interesting arrangement on the back of it. This door was barred so that people could not knock it down. There are a lot of heavy hinges, multiple heavy hinges on the right side, and a very, very heavy-duty latch on the left. And that latch had to be moved by an electric motor, and the only way to open this door was to activate that electric motor, and the only way to activate that electric motor was to connect this nail to this nail over here. And you did that by having a coat hanger, and you had to know exactly which of the nails on the door to connect together in order to get the latch to retract. So really a rather clever arrangement. The door will open when you do this, the motor goes chugga-chugga and the latch pulls back. The room itself was equipped with a rather unique feature, a bomb. That bomb would be set off if people entered the room and opened the cabinet where the bomb was located. So you can see the trigger switch here, the batteries to operate the bomb, and the TNT explosive. The cabinet looks perfectly innocent, but you would expect that if a German came along and started searching through this room, eventually they would say, gee, I wonder what's in this cabinet. And boom, the room is no more. But the Theta Room has been restored by the Norwegian government back to the way it appeared when it was being used as a spy headquarters during the war. There's a radio transmitter with an adjustable power supply built into the wall, a couple of radio receivers, a typewriter, an oscilloscope, and particularly important, a bunch of recognition diagrams so that if these spies were able to see any enemy ships or enemy airplanes, they'd be able to identify what these ships and airplanes actually were and send that information back to the British or the Allies. It was very important for the British to know what boats were in various harbors in Norway so that they would be able to bomb the important ones and not just attack randomly. They also had to have a technique for encoding their messages. They couldn't just call up England and say, hey, there's a battleship in Bergen Harbor. That wouldn't do at all. They had to send the messages in encoded form. They didn't have Enigma machines or code machines, so they had hand ciphers. They would take phrases and encode them into five-letter groups, send these five-letter groups by Morse code to the English, and then the English would decode them. One of the things that they they were particularly interested in was locating German warships. And so they would take photographs of these warships, and if they were unique enough, they would find some way to get the photograph itself back to England. But in general, they were able to identify what the ship was and send that information back to the British. They would do it in these little telegrams. This is a received telegram marked secret, February 1942, right in the early middle part of the war. Source is Theta, date of information, and so on. The message says Tirpitz, which is a major German battleship, is camouflaged with a steel net, canvas, trees, and snow. It now looks like a peninsula. We believe she has been moved to a fjord or a place with a similar name where and when will be telegraphed later. So that's critical information. The British needed to sink the Tirpitz, and here they're being told where it is. And additional information was included. Patrol boat now patrols this fjord and that fjord and islands. This boat lies up all night on the north side of another place there. There are watch posts in these locations. More accurate details later. There are many U-boats here now. And so on. The Von Tirpitz was lying in the fjord Saturday, 14th February, between two small islands. She was camouflaged as an island with woods. There is no visible damage, very difficult to see. Later on in May of 1942, the Tirpitz sustained one direct hit aft, which damaged her. This occurred during the raid. She's still lying at her old anchorage. This information is accurate. A pilot reports that several warships were sunk in Trondheim Harbor, also, and so on. All kinds of information. U-boats are being repaired daily in the floating dock at another location. So really critical information. Again, Theta information, ships that passed through Bergen on a northerly course this evening were at Neisenau and Prinz von Eugen, two huge military German ships, and they were escorted by seven destroyers. The aforementioned battleship towed to was not Tirpitz, but a battle cruiser. There are 90 airplanes now at such and such. Six troop trains leave Oslo daily for Trondheim. Ideal information if they want to bomb a troop train. 200 airplanes passed on Sunday going north. This is particularly useful information. The 50,000 German troops at Aarhus, Denmark, are waiting to go to Norway and can only go by the sea route from Denmark to Kristiansand. So ideal information for the Allies to use in tracking this. The Theta Room received news from a friend in Norway that a big roundup occurred in an area in Bergen. So they were always being hunted. This last thing says, I'm staying in the secret room until the courier comes. Can he come as early as possible, please? The station must be saved and must continue after I've left. For your information, Christian was arrested, and so on and so forth. Very scary business. You never knew whether you were going to live through the next day. And very brave people were involved in this.
You're listening to a talk about World War II clandestine spy radio operations given by Tom Pereira, Ph.D., W1TP, at the 2015 Dayton Hamvention. We'll conclude this excerpt from Tom's presentation in a moment. This is The Rain Report, accessible online at therainreport.com, via Twitter at The Rain Report, and on iTunes.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
The big problem, of course, was direction-finding devices. These radio stations were located wherever they were, and the Germans certainly wanted to find them. They wanted to find them very badly. The technique of direction-finding, for those of you who might not be familiar, is to have two receiving stations, one and two, both of which have directional antennas, and to move those antennas in a circular direction until you find a point at which the two antennas pointed toward the source of the radio information intersect, and that's the location of the sender, within a mile or so of the location of the transmitter. This was done by a number of different kinds of mobile vehicles, a German direction-finding truck in a French town, specifically designated to go around and find these spy transmitters. There were a lot of vehicles that the Germans used for direction-finding, homing in on the spies. This one has the antenna somewhat hidden under a canvas top. In this one, since it has a canvas top, the antenna could actually be mounted inside the car. So it was a direction-finding vehicle with a rotatable direction-finding antenna located right inside the vehicle. If you saw this thing coming, boy, you would run if you were transmitting. The operator would rotate the antenna and watch the signal strength meter until he got a peak or a null, depending on how the antenna was set up, and then record the bearing to that station. So these things were driving around while Paulette and these other people were transmitting, and these guys were trying to home in on them. The more insidious ones were located in Fischer Storch aircraft. These airplanes could fly extremely slowly down in the 30 to 40 mile an hour range. They're extraordinary airplanes. If you ever get up to the Collings Foundation World War II reenactment in Stowe, Massachusetts, they have one of the few still flying Fischer Storches, and for $400 you can take a flight in this thing. You feel as though you can get out and walk. I did it, and it's just amazing how slow it can fly. And it has windows that allow you to look straight down, so it's an ideal observation aircraft. An awfully easy target, however, flying at that speed. Anyway, you had aircraft, but then you also had direction-finding receivers built into suitcases, relatively innocent-looking suitcases, very much like the spy radio suitcases. Probably the most insidious of all of the direction-finding techniques was a body-worn direction finder. This guy looks like, he looks pretty evil, even without knowing what's under his coat, but if he flashes, you suddenly see that he is not just wearing a raincoat, he is a flasher. And underneath his raincoat, he has a complete direction-finding receiver. And the antenna for this receiver is sewn into the vest. So this vest is actually an antenna-containing vest, and he has this thing around his waist. And of course, again, we're dealing with tube radios, so the batteries are pretty heavy in this thing. And the readout for this, I mean, here he is. He's just walking along, and he just checks his wristwatch. And it turns out that the wristwatch is actually a field strength meter. And you look at that little dial, and it tells him as he moves his body back and forth the direction of the spy radio that he's trying to home in. The antenna is set up so that the line between the person's shoulders points directly at the transmitting station. So he would just sort of look at his time and rotate around a little bit, and when he got a null, he would know that the spy station was either there or there, and then he'd go walk a little bit and do it again and find where the two bearings crossed, and he would have a really good fix on where the spy station was. Looking at the inside of this thing, we see these strange German tubes that were quite widely used during World War II. If we look at the circuit diagram, we have just a normal direction-finding loop antenna fed into a high-gain superhead receiver. And one of the techniques that the spies eventually had to engage in to avoid direction finding was to use burst transmissions, where you would try and get an entire message in Morse code sent in a very, very short time. It would then be recorded on a tape recorder by a receiving station and slowed down. But the technique of sending these messages so fast that you were only exposed for maybe 5 seconds or less was what really worked rather well, because the guy with his direction-finding receiver couldn't turn his shoulders fast enough to home in on a 5-second transmission. And consequently, they were very important. A lot of time and energy was put into developing burst transmission encoders. And again, this is nicely covered in Mielstein's book. Here is a very early technique called a squirt encoder. And what you did was set up these little rods with dashes and dots that corresponded to the Morse code. And then you would run a wire along them. And for the light-colored ones, it would be dots, and the dark-colored ones would be dashes or something like that. With a bunch of these, you could have preset messages that you were sending, like the initial call sign and the kind of information you were going to send, and it was all contained in a little box. So this is sort of a basic technique for sending a very fast transmission. Just move your hand down this rod as fast as you can, and the receiving station records it and eventually slows it down. So that's sort of a summary of what happened with these occupied areas. And this is a picture at the end of the war when people finally were allowed to have their radios back. You can see their smiles, and they're looking forward to being able to listen to radio stations again without being shot for having the receivers.
And that concludes our two excerpts from a 2015 Dayton Hamvention talk by Tom Pereira, Ph.D., W1TP, an expert on the clandestine spy radio operations in World War II. You can read a great deal more about the so-called Enigma cipher machine, the primary coding machine adopted for all branches of the German military and high command starting in 1926. Check out Tom's Enigma Museum website. See the Rain Sites Mentioned page for the URL. And a reminder, if you're headed to the Dayton Hamvention in a couple of weeks, be sure to drop by booth 329 and say hello to the Amateur Radio Information Network and the Gateway 160-meter radio newsletter. You just might be interviewed for the Rain Report. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2016 Rain. All rights are reserved. For Rain's founder and producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, bidding you a very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network, online at therainreport.com, at The Rain Report on Twitter, and via iTunes.